1 Thessalonians 4:13 through 5:11. The fourth talk in a series on 1 and 2 Thessalonians was presented by Ron Julian on February 11, 2007 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2007. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
It's true, I have a cold, which means that I can't guarantee that any number of disgusting organic sorts of processes might happen up here. I was thinking about what you could do instead while that was happening. You might want to turn and admire the nice windows that we put in. They're very nice. I was thinking that you could emulate the Bereans, who were more noble than the Thessalonians, and search the scriptures to see whether these things were so. And then I'm sure it'll only be a moment. We're continuing in our series in the Thessalonian letters. We're in 1 Thessalonians. We're coming to that part of the letter where Paul starts talking about the second coming of Christ. And then in 2 Thessalonians, he also addresses that issue. Some of you may recall that initially I was considering teaching on the issues regarding the second coming during this time of my teaching, and I decided to just go through the Thessalonian letters instead. So here we are. We're starting to look at some of that. The subject of the end times can be kind of a frustrating one, I think. There are a lot of passages involved in trying to put together a coherent picture of what's going on, which is why I really wanted in this session not to try to do that, but to just look at specific passages and try to see what's going on there. And I don't know, I mean, maybe it's only me, but my impression is this topic tends to kind of bring out the worst in Christians. I have a penance that I do sometimes. I wander around on the internet looking at what Christians say about things in their blogs and that kind of stuff, and we get really cranky about this topic, as far as I can tell. You start talking about this and people get downright nasty arguing with each other as to whether it's pre or post or all of that kind of stuff. So it's a hard topic, and it's kind of an aggravating topic in some ways. But on the other hand, I am firmly convinced that the return of Christ is central to our hope as believers. Peter urges us to fix our hope completely on the grace that Christ is bringing when he appears again. He says that it is because we know that these promises are true and that ultimately things are going to turn out that way, that we have the incentive to live holy lives now. So I'm firmly convinced that our faith is focused on the return of Christ. It is a central theme in what it means to be a Christian. We believe that Christ died for our sins so that we might be rescued from sin and death to live in his eternal kingdom forever, which is all going to be inaugurated when he returns. So my goal in the next several weeks is to just try to concentrate on what Paul says in the Thessalonian letters, to see what they contribute to our understanding of this topic. I do not have any grand plans of laying out the master plan. You know, I had the 16-color chart, you know, showing, you know, who the Antichrist was and how it all happens, but I lost it somewhere. So instead, I'm just going to try to see what is it that Paul was trying to get across to the Thessalonians, and we'll see what that contributes to our understanding of this topic. Now, let me give you fair warning. Two perspectives that I do not embrace, and I think it's just fair to make it clear up front. First of all, in American Christianity, the majority view of the Second Coming has been informed by dispensationalism, dispensational premillennialism, pre-tribulation rapture, and all of that kind of stuff. This is what you see reflected in the popular Left Behind series of books, if any of you are familiar with those or saw the fabulous movies that were made as a result of them. I'm sorry, that was a snarky thing to say, actually. But I didn't think they were very good. So, okay, so the thing is, it is a very popular perspective, but it is not one that I embrace. I don't think it accurately reflects biblical teaching, and I'll have a little bit more to say about that later. But if the only teaching you've ever heard on this topic has been from that perspective, and you thought that's what everybody thought, I'm just warning you, that's not what I think, so it's going to be coming from a little different place. And then secondly, there is a minority view concerning the second coming that I also do not embrace. This perspective, I mentioned it several weeks back, this perspective is called preterism. The idea is that everything in the New Testament that refers to the second coming of Christ is talking about stuff that has already happened in our past. That the destruction of Jerusalem by the Romans was Christ coming in wrath and coming to overthrow the old Jewish perversion of what God was doing so that the church could be established free from that perversion. One of my personal goals in this series has been to try to understand that perspective a little better. I'm not going to talk about it really much here, because the problem is the issues are very technical and complex, and it really deserves more of like an academic paper or something to take on the question of why I don't embrace that. But I just want to tell you up front that the more I've been looking at that, the less compelling I find it, and that's not where I'm coming from here. If you're at all familiar with that full preterism perspective, you'll recognize that what I'm going to say here about this passage is not what they would say, because they would basically say that everything we're about to read is not talking about Jesus coming one day. It's not talking about us meeting him in the air and all of the stuff that it sounds like it's talking about. It's talking about the wrath of God poured out on Israel and the establishment of the church back in the first century. And all of that stuff has already happened. I'm not going to go into why I don't think that's true, but I'd be happy to talk to you about it if you'd like. So, those two places, those two perspectives, I am not embracing in what I'm talking about here. I don't share the popular view, the left behind kind of view, the view that I first learned when I read Hal Lindsey's book many years ago, The Late Great Planet Earth. That's not where I'm coming from, nor do I share this kind of growing minority view that basically all this stuff already happened. Okay, so we're starting in chapter 4, verse 13. Kind of a different topic for us to be talking about. We don't talk about this stuff all that often. In 1 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 13. But we do not want you to be uninformed, brethren, about those who are asleep, that you may not grieve as do the rest who have no hope. For if we believe that Jesus died and rose again, in the same way also God will bring with him those who have fallen asleep in Jesus. I find it a little hard to know exactly what the Thessalonians were thinking that Paul is responding to here. He's clearly responding to something that he has heard from Timothy. It's been over half a year since he was there last, and he had only been there perhaps a month or two. And he's heard something about what they're thinking that he wants to clarify. It might sound, in what he says there, that they didn't know anything about the idea of life after death, and he wanted to clarify that and explain to them that there was life after death. I don't think that's exactly what's going on. It's not very plausible that Paul would talk about the gospel and not talk to them about eternal life. We know they had been taught that Jesus was coming again. Paul describes them earlier as waiting for God's Son from heaven. But what seems to be going on is that some of them now have died in the over half a year since he was there. At least one person, maybe several people, have died. And this sort of brought them up short. Paul had talked about Jesus coming back, and they were excited about this idea that Jesus was going to come back and establish his kingdom. But now somebody died, and where does that leave them? Are they going to kind of miss out on this stuff, or how exactly is this stuff going to work? So I think that's the issue that Paul is addressing. He's trying to clarify for them what he had meant when he was talking about the return of Christ and what that means for us. Of course, we modern Christians are used to this. I mean, Christians have been dying for thousands of years since Paul proclaimed this stuff. We're used to the idea that many Christians have died, and when Jesus returns, that he will be returning both for those who died and those who are alive. But they were just getting started with this stuff. They'd only really known Paul for like a month, and they're trying to sort this stuff out, they've gotten a little confused. So Paul reminds them, as we see here, at the heart of the gospel story is resurrection. The Christ, our Savior, died and then rose from the dead, and God is going to do the same thing for those believers who have died. He is going to bring them along with Christ. And so now Paul's going to explain specifically how this is going to work. In verse 15, "For this we say to you by the word of the Lord, that we who are alive and remain until the coming of the Lord shall not precede those who have fallen asleep. Because the Lord himself will descend from heaven with a commanding shout, with the voice of an archangel, and with the trumpet of God, and the dead in Christ shall rise first. Then we who are alive and remain shall be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air, and thus we shall always be with the Lord. Therefore, encourage one another with these words." Paul starts out by emphasizing that this explanation is not just his idea. He received it from the Lord, from Jesus himself. He's saying, this is what the Lord has told me is going to happen. The basic idea, when Jesus returns, he's going to gather all his people together, both those who died and those who are alive at the time when he returns. And if anything, Paul is emphasizing, there is a priority given to those who have died. It's not a disadvantage to have died before Jesus returns, because the first thing he's going to do when he's coming is raise up his people. So those who have been dead will be raised up, and then those who are alive will be gathered together with them, and as one group, those who had been dead and those who were still alive, all together will meet Christ and be with him, always be with him. The basic idea here comes from Jesus himself. In the Olivet Discourse, where he talks about what is going to be happening, he says, "And he will send forth his angels with a great trumpet, and they will gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of the sky to the other." So Jesus saying, on that great day when he returns, the trumpet will sound, just as Paul used that language, and Jesus' chosen ones will be gathered to him. This is basically a teaching that Jesus gave. Then the issue is, presumably that means both the dead and the living, those who are elect, who are chosen, who have died, and those who are alive. And so Paul is clarifying, yes, in fact, that's how it's going to work. The dead will be raised and join with Christ, and the living will be gathered together with them, and as one group, they will come to Christ and be with him. Paul explains this same event in 1 Corinthians chapter 15. There the issue is a little different. He's correcting a group that rejects the idea of resurrection. So he's arguing for the resurrection from the fact of Christ's resurrection, and he's explaining a little bit about the nature of that resurrection. Because of that, he goes into more detail about the nature of our transformed, resurrected bodies. So in 15:50, you don't have to turn there, I'm just going to read this briefly from 1 Corinthians. "Now I say this, brethren, that flesh and blood cannot inherit the kingdom of God, nor does the perishable inherit the imperishable. Behold, I tell you a mystery. We shall not all sleep, but we shall all be changed. In a moment, in the twinkling of an eye, at the last trumpet, For the trumpet will sound, and the dead will be raised imperishable, and we shall be changed. So, here we see the return of Christ represents that moment when all of his chosen ones are transformed. They're gathered together with him, but they are transformed in the process. Those who have been dead receive a new resurrected sort of body, which is, as Paul goes on to talk about, spiritual in the way that we could try to sort out. But there's this new existence, this new mode of life that they have been resurrected into. And then he's saying those who are alive are changed at the same time. If you were dead, you are brought to life to a resurrected body. And if you are living, then you are transformed and changed into this new mode of existence. So, all of us who meet Jesus when he returns have been transformed into a new mode of life. And basically, this is the picture that Paul has. This is what's going to happen. Now, let me take a little detour here for a second. In verse 17, Paul says that those who are alive shall be caught up. In the Latin Vulgate, this verb, caught up, is from the verb rapio, and I don't know Latin, so I couldn't tell you much about it, but from which we get the word rapture. So the rapture, when we talk about the rapture, it comes from this passage where those who are alive are caught up, are snatched up to be with those who have died together with Christ. But you're probably aware that in modern American Christianity, the rapture has come to have a more specific association. And we don't talk about this stuff much around here, so I thought I would just take a minute to explain it, although I'm sure many of you know this stuff already. Thinking about that book, Left Behind, where did that title come from? The title comes from the idea that I think in the story, if I remember, I actually read the first book in the series. It is so tempting to make nasty comments about that book. I'm sorry. Read that book. It starts out, the people are in an airplane, and all of a sudden a bunch of people in the plane have disappeared. And they find out that all over the earth, people have disappeared. And there are all these people who have been left behind. All the Christians have disappeared, and their clothes are there in a heap, and their watches there, and their dentures are there, and that kind of stuff. I mean, that's the picture. This happens all over the world. Meanwhile, those who were not believers are left behind, and they must go through the tribulation when the Antichrist shows up and this terrible time comes on the earth. And because they weren't believers, they have been left behind and they have to face it. Some people become believers during that period of time, and they're left to face the difficulty with the Antichrist and so on. And that's kind of the premise of the book. And that's the basic picture that most... I think it's fair to say that that's the most popular picture of what the return of Christ is all about. That's how it's going to happen. It involves a picture of kind of two returns of Christ. Christ comes back invisibly in a way that no one sees except a bunch of people have disappeared. And then we have this period of difficulty and trouble. And then he comes back triumphantly at the end of that to establish his kingdom and so on. Now, I just want to explain, just briefly, where I would be coming from on that stuff. I'm well aware that this is the kind of stuff that Christians really like to fight about. And I'm a lover, not a fighter. You all know that. I don't want to pick a fight with anybody, but I just want you to understand why that picture, just briefly, why that picture isn't so compelling to me. Because we're not going to see it in this passage in 1 Thessalonians. There's nothing in this passage that would suggest anything like that's going to happen. So where did that come from? This is my understanding of where this stuff comes from. You could find somebody else that would say, I'm being terribly unfair and I don't get it at all. So just be warned that this is not the last word. But just briefly, in the 1800s, there was a guy named John Darby who came to have a great influence, especially in America, although he was not an American. I would describe the situation as being like this, and from the things that I've read, others would say this is not a fair picture, but I get the idea that Darby was a guy who was greatly troubled about the relationship between law and grace. He had one of those kind of Luther sort of experiences where he felt very much a sinner and unworthy, and he didn't know how to deal with that problem. And he was especially troubled by things that he saw in the Bible that called us to be obedient and to live a holy life. Reading the Ten Commandments is very disturbing. Reading the things in the Old Testament are very disturbing because I just don't seem to live up to that. And he saw as the solution to that problem to draw this very hard line between the church and Israel. That if we could, this is where the idea of dispensationalism comes along. We divide history into various dispensations, and we are living in the dispensation of the church. What applied to Israel on either side of us, Israel in the past and Israel in the future, doesn't apply to us. So strict dispensationalism, the hardcore dispensationalists who came after Darby would argue that the Sermon on the Mount is not really relevant to us. The Ten Commandments are not relevant to us. That's all Israel stuff. We are justified by faith in Jesus. And that stuff doesn't really have anything to do with us. Well, prophecy entered into his picture of this as well. The church was this little parentheses in history. You have God dealing with Israel and making various promises as to what was going to happen to Israel. The church comes along and, as people sometimes put it, the prophetic clock stops. What the prophets had said about what was going to happen, it's like we're on hold. We're in this period of the church. And when Jesus comes invisibly to snatch the church away, then the clock starts ticking again and we're back talking about Israel, and Israel is going to be at the head of what's happening. That was... So the prophetic picture that Darby proposed was tied to this dispensational picture that the church is a separate deal from Israel. And what the church is doing, going off to heaven and being with Jesus, doesn't really have anything to do with what God is doing with Israel, which is to establish a theocratic kingdom and so on. So, as a part of this picture then, dispensationalism came to embrace what you will hear people refer to as the pre-tribulation rapture. The rapture happens before the tribulation comes on the earth, and from the way some people read the book of Daniel, they say, well, it's in Revelation, it's 7 years of this terrible tribulation, but the church has gone, and now it's Israel's troubles that we're looking at. So that's sort of where this came from, and that's the popular view that you will find out there. Let me just give you three very brief, very, very brief reasons why that's not where I would be coming from. And there's a lot to say here, and this is way too simplistic, but I just want to give you a kind of an idea. My first response would be, when we come to passages like the one we're looking at here today, it doesn't paint this picture at all. It really sounds, when you read Jesus talking about what's going to happen or Paul talking about what's going to happen, it really sounds like all of this stuff happens together. Jesus comes back, we are gathered to him, the unrighteous are judged, the kingdom is established. It is just this one, Jesus comes back and gets it going. I mean, that's the picture that you get when you read most of these passages. My first problem is I don't see this perspective being taught in the passages that ought to be talking about it. My second problem is that my understanding of the fundamental reason that Darby went this direction and what characterized much of especially early dispensational teaching is this desire to separate the law and the gospel. And I think the solution that Darby proposed is wrong. I think he's trying to solve the problem in the wrong way. And actually, I think it's a bad way. It's a bad to somehow take moral obligation and put it all on the Jews and say, we're just in a situation where we're justified by faith and nothing that the law says has really anything to do with us, which is where the strict dispensationalists were going. I just think that's the wrong way to go. That's not the way to try to put those things together. And many modern-day dispensationalists have come to recognize that that really doesn't work too well and have kind of backed off of the original rationale for dispensationalism altogether. So, theologically, I'm not attracted to that system. I don't think they've understood the most fundamental issue there. And then the last thing I would say is that oftentimes when you read people who argue for this perspective, and in particular this pre-tribulation rapture, the idea that Jesus comes sort of secretly and takes us away, but everybody else is left here for a while and all this stuff goes on. Oftentimes, the main reason that people appeal to, the reason that it's most important to them, is that if it's not true, then the church goes through the tribulation. That's the thing that they keep coming back to. They would point specifically to what Paul is going to say in a few verses later here. For God has not destined us for wrath, but for obtaining salvation through our Lord Jesus Christ. And they would say, see, the tribulation period is this period of time when the wrath of God is going to be poured out on the earth. But we've been told that we are not destined for wrath. So we have to be taken away before this terrible time comes on the earth, because otherwise God wouldn't be keeping his promise. One of the older authors who wrote on this stuff, a very big book on the issue of the second coming and all of that stuff, he used to say, Paul talked about the blessed hope. And he would say, my blessed hope is that I'm not going to have to go through the tribulation when all of that stuff happens. What's your blessed hope? With the kind of the implication is, if you are not a pre-tribulation rapture dispensationalist, then you are saying, my blessed hope is I'm going to suffer greatly when the Antichrist brings trouble on the world. But here's where, whatever is true about these perspectives, that argument I think is a profound mistake, and we have to understand how profound a mistake that is. Because the fact is that God has always dealt with his people by refining their faith, by taking them through times of trouble. I mean, what would Pentecost, J. Dwight Pentecost, this author, what would he say if he could stand there talking to a Christian who was facing the lions in the Colosseum? You know, my blessed hope is that I'm not going to go through the tribulation. What's yours? Well, I think they would say that after I am eaten by this lion, that Jesus is going to return again and bring me into his eternal kingdom, which is, in fact, what our blessed hope is. The blessed hope is not a promise that we are going to escape trouble in this life. It is that God will be faithful to us throughout whatever trouble we go through, that if we are faithful to him, we will enter into life. So the idea that somehow God has promised that when big trouble, if that's the picture, if that's right, that when big trouble comes upon the world, that his people will be taken away so they don't have to go through it, it's just that doesn't fit very well the pattern of the way God deals with things. And in fact, you sort of see a picture in Revelation when the angels are about to pour out this great trouble on the world. God says, well, wait, let me mark my folks so that you don't get them. The idea being not that they're going to be taken away so they don't go through it, but that they will be preserved in the midst of it, that God will faithfully preserve them and they will enter into life in the end. So it's for reasons like that that I don't embrace that picture, and where I would be coming from is we have a simple picture that's painted here. Jesus returns once. He comes back. His return gathers us together with him. In his return, he judges unbelief and unrighteousness on the earth and establishes his kingdom, and that's how I would see it happening. Is mine the last word on that? No. Could I be convinced that that other perspective was right? Certainly I could. As to how exactly it happens, I hope you would feel the same. I'm not particularly invested in any particular picture one way or the other. It's for God to tell us what he's going to do. And whatever it is he's going to do, I will accept. But right now, that perspective doesn't make too much sense to me. Okay, so there's my little detour. I just wanted to comment on that because that's what you'll hear. That other perspective is very common out there. Give you just a brief idea of why I'm not coming from there. Okay, so let's come back then now to what Paul is saying in the text here. I want to take us into chapter 5, verse 1, where he says, "Now as to the times and seasons, brethren, you have no need of anything to be written to you." This is the question that always fascinates us. Okay, now we're getting down to it. We're talking about the times and the seasons. Paul's going to tell us, how's this going to happen? When's this going to happen? How am I going to know when it's going to happen? Who's the Antichrist? What does 666 mean? When I first started into this stuff, when I first became a Christian, we were all fascinated. I don't hear people doing this stuff so much anymore. Maybe I'm just not listening to the right people. But when I started at this stuff, everybody was, let's count up the letters in Henry Kissinger's name, and add them up and see what we can do and see if he's the Antichrist. Honestly, you cannot read the late great Planet Earth and not get the very strong impression that Hal Lindsey was saying, in a couple of years, this is all going to be over. So, and it wasn't. And so we kind of have to go back to Plan B, figure out what exactly is going on with this stuff. So the question about the times and seasons, this is the thing that we get to arguing about is, how do I know? What's going to happen? What are the signs? How can I tell? Does the fact that Israel is back together, does that mean it's about to happen? If I see troops massing on this border over here, is that what it's talking about in Revelation? And should I, what should I do? That's the stuff that we really get off on. So maybe Paul is going to answer that question now. Now as to the times and seasons, brethren, let me straighten you out. Here's how it's going to work. Well, he says that they have no need of anything to be written to them. That doesn't sound real promising, because it sounds like he's not going to tell them. And that's kind of right. He's not. Why would he say that they don't need to be told anything? Is it that he's already told them all the details? You guys already know. I told you about 666, and you know who the Antichrist is, and you know what year it's going to happen, and the whole deal. So you don't need anything told to you about the times and epochs, the times and seasons, because I've told you all of that stuff already. Well, no, I don't think so. We already know. They didn't know enough to know that when Jesus came back, the dead were raised first, and then those who were living went with them. That was a pretty fundamental thing, and he had to clarify that to them. And when we get to 2 Thessalonians, there's a bunch of other stuff that they're not real clear about as well. So it's not as if they have this great picture of this is exactly how it's going to work. I think there is a different reason, a more important reason, why Paul says that they don't need to have anything written to them about this. And I think that's very important. It's actually going to help get us to get perspective on this issue. How should we think about the second coming and about knowing the times and seasons and so on? Okay. In verse 2 he says, "For you yourselves know full well that the day of the Lord will come just like a thief in the night." First of all, the day of the Lord. The day of the Lord is a basic biblical concept. It shows up in the Old Testament. It shows up in the New Testament. And the idea is this, as I understand it. Actually, this may seem sort of crass, but I think we can see what kind of ideas is associated with this. If you think of that old expression, every dog has his day. That to have your day is, okay, things are going along, and it doesn't seem as if things are clicking for you, but there's going to come this day when it's going to be your day. And when your day comes, then look out. Well, I think that's what we're talking about here. Basically, life seems to go on the same year after year. Unrighteousness keeps winning. Bad things keep happening. And it seems like God is kind of losing. I mean, you look at the world and things are bad and they keep being bad and there have been wars and there's still wars and now we're better at killing each other than we used to be. And, I mean, that's the world that we live in. What's God doing? When is God going to do something? Well, there is this day coming. It's the day of the Lord. Right now, it's our day. We seem to be on top. But there's coming this day when the Lord is going to step in and it's going to be His day. On that day, God steps in and says, now it's my turn. It's a day of salvation, but it's also a day of judgment, depending on who you are. This day, and Paul is clearly connecting it with the return of Christ, it's coming like a thief in the night. This metaphor is taken straight from Jesus in the Olivet Discourse, and I think it's a very important metaphor, helps us to see what's going on. Jesus said, "But be sure of this, that if the head of the house had known at what time of the night the thief was coming, he would have been on the alert and would not have allowed his house to be broken into. For this reason, you be ready too, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour when you do not think he will." Okay, so here's this analogy. What's the whole thing about being a thief is you're not going to do well as a thief if you announce in advance when you're coming. If you send a note and saying, you know, next week, about 2 a.m, I'll be there robbing your house. Make sure to, you know, stay out of the way while I'm doing things. That's not the way it works. The way a thief works is he works on that presumption that we all have, that we fall into, is that everything is always going to go along the way it always has. When I go to bed and I look around and I see all my stuff, when I wake up in the morning, it will all still be there. Because it was there the day before, and it was there the day before that, and it was there the day before that. So my expectation is it's always going to be there. Things are always going to go along the way I thought. But with the thief, he's taking advantage of the fact that you have that expectation, and he comes at a time when you're not expecting. There are two ways of dealing with this problem, the fact that there are thieves and they can break in. One of them is to just take that stance of ignorant oblivion. Hey, every day I get up and my stuff is still there, and that's the way it will always be. I don't believe in thieves. They're out there, but my life is going to go on uninterrupted. Nothing's going to happen to me. Or, with a thief, you can be prepared and vigilant. I don't know when the thief is going to come, but that means that I have to be prepared all the time. I have to assume that the thief could be there at any time. And so I will try to be vigilant, alert, and prepared, so that if the thief comes, I'll be prepared for him. Well, I think that's what Paul is going to expand on now. The two possible ways that we can deal with the day of the Lord are like these two approaches that you can take to a thief coming. The first way is the way that the unbelieving world is going to deal with this day of the Lord that is coming like a thief in the night. And that's what he says in verse 3. While they are saying peace and safety, then destruction will come upon them suddenly, like birth pangs upon a woman with child, and they shall not escape. The world is like the homeowner who goes to bed thinking, every night when I go to bed, I have all this stuff, and when I wake up in the morning, it's still there. And that's what's going to happen tonight as well. They're saying peace and safety. Things are okay. We've got it together. We have made things okay for ourselves, and this is going to continue on. Things are good, and they're going to continue to be good. We're in control of our lives. We're making it happen. And then the day of the Lord comes breaking in unexpectedly. This is not what I was looking for. I was expecting to reap the rewards of my care for my life in this world. God steps in to judge, and destruction comes upon them as suddenly as birth pangs come to a pregnant woman. The idea being that you're going along and you weren't expecting it, and all of a sudden, the pain hits. That's the way the day of the Lord is going to come in, like a thief in the night. They were oblivious. They were not taking God seriously. They never thought that one day they were going to have to deal with him, but now the day has come. This is part of why the Thessalonians don't need to have any more of this explained to them. They knew enough to know that God has not announced his timetable in advance. He's going to step into history when people are not expecting it. So, concerning the times and seasons, they know that God has not told us the times and seasons. We don't know when this is going to happen, just like we don't know when the thief would come. But I think there's an even more important reason why they don't need to have anything explained to them, and that arises from what Paul goes on to say. But you, brethren, are not in darkness, that the day should overtake you like a thief. For you are all sons of light and sons of day. We are not of night nor of darkness. So then let us not sleep as others do, but let us be alert and sober. For those who sleep do their sleeping at night, and those who get drunk at night. But since we are of the day, let us be sober, having put on the breastplate of faith and love, and as a helmet, the hope of salvation. What I understand to be going on here is Paul is taking Jesus' metaphor and expanding on it, this idea of the thief in the night. The world is overtaken by the day of the Lord, coming like a thief in the night, because that's their situation. It's like it's nighttime. They're in the dark. They don't understand. They don't see what's going on. The nighttime is the time when the light is gone. So what do you do when the light is gone? You fall asleep, or maybe you get drunk. The light is gone. It's not the time to do anything. So instead of being alert and being sober, you go to sleep. Or you distract yourself with the dissipation of getting drunk. So instead of being alert, instead of being awake and aware, there is something coming and I need to deal with it. They're asleep. Instead of being sober and recognizing there are serious issues here that I have to deal with, they have distracted themselves the way someone who's getting drunk is distracting themselves with alcohol. Instead of being sober, they are dissipating themselves. They are distracting themselves from the things that they need to be dealing with. But as believers, we are not in the dark. We know something. We have the light. We know that God is there. We know that he is offering salvation through Christ. We know that we have this great hope in front of us. What we know is a hugely important question, because Paul is not saying here, you know when Jesus is coming back. You know what the signs are that will tell you when he's going to be there. It's not that he's saying to us, I'll tell you what it's going to look like in advance so that then you can get ready when you see that stuff. What he's saying is, you're ready because you're always ready. It doesn't matter when it happens, because the believers are in the light, they're alert, they are sober, they are prepared for his return. But what's the nature of that preparation? Do they know who the Antichrist is? No. The nature of that preparation is that they have put on the breastplate of faith and love, and as a helmet, the hope of salvation. We are awake. We are sober. We know what's at stake. We are dealing with the central issue of our lives. God is real. God has promised us life. God has given us a great hope. God has called us to love one another, and that's what life is all about. That's what our lives are about. He has promised us life. We believe that promise. We love each other because of that promise. And we have a great hope because of that promise that one day we will enter into salvation, a complete salvation that awaits us, saved, rescued from the whole problem of life, sin, death, the whole deal. So this is the picture, I think. The day of the Lord comes like a thief in the night on the world because the world is not ready. The world doesn't expect that anyone is going to be there. But it's not coming like a thief in the night for God's people because we have heard his promises and we believe them. We don't know when it's going to happen, but we know that it's going to happen. And we are living in the light of those truths. So we're ready. We are of the day. We are in the light. We know. We're awake. We're sober. For God has not destined us for wrath, but for obtaining salvation through our Lord Jesus Christ, who died for us, that whether we are awake or asleep, we may live together with him. Therefore, encourage one another and build up one another, just as also you are doing. So, we know that there is a great day of wrath coming upon the unbelieving world, but we will escape that wrath because we are pursuing faith, hope, and love. Paul brings it back to the original subject, this problem of what happens to the people who died. He says, whether we are awake or asleep, which is to say, this is not the same awake or asleep he was just talking about, I think. You have to be awake in one sense. You can't be drunk and not alert. But now he's saying, whether awake or asleep, which is his euphemistic way of saying whether alive or dead, we will be with Christ. Jesus died for us so that we might live with him. His death, our life. And that applies to the ones who died as well as to the ones who are still alive when he returns. And Paul says that this is meant to be important to us. We are supposed to encourage each other with what he has said here. This message is supposed to give us courage and comfort and hope in the midst of what we're facing. And remember, they were facing difficulties of many sorts, including the fact that some people had died. Okay, so it seems to me that the return of Christ is meant to be the great focus of our lives. And in this passage, we can see two reasons why that might be the case. First of all, the return of Christ is the hope that gives meaning to our lives today. I mean, there are all sorts of analogies that we could think about where my understanding of what's going to happen in the future is what determines how I think about my situation now. And, you know, I talk about these things all the time, but why do I go hiking through the wilderness toward some goal? Why did Israel, at least in theory, go into the wilderness following God to the promised land? Because there was a goal, because there was some place to go. And there are many things that we do now, that we invest ourselves in now, because we think that they're going someplace. We think that they're taking us someplace we want to go. So Paul's message to them is, this is the thing that should encourage us. In this world, we struggle with sin and futility and death and decay. But Jesus is coming to call us together to himself. When he calls us, we will be transformed. On the day that Jesus comes again is the day when life begins for real for us. We will know God. We will know Jesus. We will know each other as we should. We will be what we have longed to be as human beings. This is our great hope. That's why, like the Thessalonians, we are waiting for his Son from heaven. And that's why Paul encourages them by this picture. Whether you're dead or whether you're alive, all of us together will join him. And that's when life will start. The second reason why this needs to be a focus for us is because of this idea of the day of the Lord. The fact is that life is not going to go on the way it seems to be going on now. You and I all know what our problems are. Each of us could sit down and do a whole day's talk on, you know, here are my problems. Here are the things that are going on. Here's my problem here. Here's this person I know's problem. This is my problem with this other person I know. I mean, we all, and those things are significant. They are the arena in which God is calling us to live out our faith, to love each other, to remember what's true. But the fact is that it's not going to last. That there is going to come a time when this stuff is gone and we're going to have to deal directly with our Creator. The day of the Lord is coming. That means that we have to deal with this now. The thief is coming and will break in. If I live as if there is no thief and every day will be like the day before, I will get up and all my stuff will be there, then I'm a fool because the thief is coming. And while he hasn't told us when, he has told us that he is coming. God has announced it to us. I'm on my way. There is a day coming when all of this is going to be wrapped up. And we have to decide, am I going to be oblivious or am I going to be ready? You know, we have a commonsensical sort of expression that we relate to all sorts of things in life. We talk about someone who is shuffling the deck chairs on the Titanic. You know, the idea that someone who is really focused on this particular little thing that is going on and yet has lost sight of the fact that there is this iceberg coming and there are more important things to deal with than where are the chairs on the deck. Because this ship is going down and where the chairs were is not going to matter. Well, we apply that to all kinds of situations, you know, in a business situation. This person, they're just, you know, here we are bleeding money over here, and this person is worried about, you know, where are people sitting around the table or something like that, you know, the deck chairs on the Titanic. Well, basically what Paul is saying is that the world around us is shuffling the deck chairs on the Titanic. It has lost sight of the fact that there is an iceberg coming and this ship is going down. And what am I going to do about that? I know that it's popular to kind of disdain the idea, the Christian message of pie in the sky, or the idea that there is a judgment coming and you had better deal with it. But that's the biblical message. There is a great hope for God's people. There is a great judgment coming on the world. And both of those things are realities, or else they're not. I mean, maybe Paul just made this stuff up. Maybe there was no Jesus. Maybe none of this is true. But I think it's true. And if it is, then it's something that we have to come to terms with. What's helpful to me about this passage, though, is that it helps us to understand what it means to come to terms with that. And this is what has been helpful to me, because when I first became a Christian, and I've told the story many times, but you know, the first book I read was The Late Great Planet Earth by Hal Lindsey, and this was all new to me. I mean, I didn't know when I became a Christian. Honestly, I mean, I know this seems strange, but when I became a Christian, it was all about me admitting reluctantly that God was there and that He had a right to tell me what life was about. That was really what I did. I didn't know, I had forgotten that Christians believed in life after death. I wasn't even thinking about that issue. The issue was, is there a God and does He have the right to come along and tell me what life is all about? So when I read The Late Great Planet Earth, I thought, wow, this is cool. Jesus is coming back and we're going to live with Him forever. And, you know, and I thought this was great. And I started, I mean, you know the first teaching on the Bible I ever did? It was probably like within a month of me becoming a Christian in this high school Bible study that somebody was doing. They said, oh, you've read The Late Great Planet Earth. Why don't you come teach us on biblical prophecy? And I did. I mean, I went in and I taught them about biblical prophecy because I had read Hal Lindsey. So, and I would like to say that I was a little bit embarrassed by it. I actually said, you know, I don't really know much about this. But they wanted to have me do it, so I did. But But what I came to see after a while, I mean, I threw myself into that stuff, and I was joking about the colored charts and everything, but I was making those colored charts. I was like snipping, making a new Bible, snipping verses out of Ezekiel and Daniel and the Olivet Discourse and that stuff, and putting them all together and saying, okay, it's like a jigsaw puzzle. If you can put them all together this way, then you can come up with this great, and I was going to have it all figured out. There's something, especially some sorts of minds, and at that spot in my life, I had one of those kind of minds, and maybe I still do, I don't know, but you know, there's just this attraction to, it's a puzzle. I'm going to figure out this puzzle. You know, God put a puzzle in the Bible, but he wouldn't have put that puzzle there if it wasn't meant to be solved, and I'm going to be the one to solve it, you know. So, you know, it was crazy, but one of the most important things that happened to me early on was coming to recognize that there was something fundamentally wrong about that approach to this question. I was really abusing the Bible. I wasn't paying any attention to the context or where these things came from. But I had really lost sight of what was important. Why are we even talking about this stuff? And it wasn't until I finally came to realize that the important thing was for me to decide, what am I hoping in? What am I looking for in life? And that if I had committed myself to the right thing, that it ultimately didn't matter whether I knew when exactly it was going to happen or how it was going to happen or who the Antichrist was or any of that kind of stuff. And I think that was a very important kind of place to come to. Well, what Paul tells us here is helpful to get that perspective. Because what Paul's saying is, you are of the light. You are not in the dark. His coming is not going to overtake you like a thief in the night. But he's talking to people who barely have just a brief and bare understanding of Christian theology and certainly don't understand the intricacies of biblical prophecy. But why is it that they're in the light? Why is it that it's not going to overtake them like a thief? Because they are busy investing themselves in believing the gospel and hoping in the promise of the gospel and loving each other in the light of the promise of the gospel. And it is those people who believe and invest themselves in the gospel that will be prepared when Jesus comes. So what's important in this passage, I think, is what being prepared doesn't mean having the 16-color chart. Being prepared means being a person of faith who believes that God will keep his promises. And then people who have all sorts of different perspectives on when and how it was going to happen. You know, I've said this before, but I kind of picture, like, you know, there'll be this one day, you know, somewhere along the line, Jesus will gather us all together after we've been in the kingdom of God for a while and say, okay, this is going to be fun. We're gonna have a show of hands and see how many people got it right. You know, how many people actually knew how this was going to go down when it happened? You know, kind of like, you know, bingo or something. You know, somebody go, yes, I got it right. And it'll be this really weird guy that nobody ever listened to. You know, everybody thought he was a real crackpot. So that'll be fine. But the idea is that all of those people will be with him there who didn't have it right, because having it right wasn't the focus. That wasn't what it was about. So on the one hand, this is everything. We have to be prepared. We have to live as if this world is not going to last and my eternal destiny depends on what Jesus does with me when he comes back. And yet on the other hand, we have to approach this topic loosely, recognizing that it's a difficult one to sort out and that we can understand how people might come to different perspectives and that the point isn't to be the one who gets to raise his hand and say, I had it right, when we have that meeting down the line. But did I invest my life in the right stuff? And that seems to me to be the most important thing that we can learn from this stuff, is that what matters is that I see Jesus coming as the point of history and the point of my life. And if I see it that way, then I'm ready. Okay, so we have time for a brief few questions or comments. Thanks, Brian.
I agree firmly with you about Darby, but there's two things that kind of come to mind while you were talking about this. Now, you're talking about the preparedness thing, and with the foolish virgins, the ones having the extra oil. Okay, but they were going to a wedding feast. And what comes to mind is Jesus used a lot of terms as espoused to the church. And the Jewish tradition on this is that the man will say to his fiance, I will come and get you, and I'm going to my father's house to prepare a place. And when he says, you're ready, I'll come and get you. And then what follows is that they are in some way secluded for a particular time. And they are in some ways isolated from the world. And so that inclines me to think that there is some type of pre-trib because of this isolation period, and Jesus is coming back for his bride.
Well, I see what you're saying. The question always is one of, when we're talking about a metaphor, the question is how far to take it.
Oh, I agree, yeah.
And the question is whether that particular detail of the way weddings were handled is an applicable analogy to what happens. I don't see any necessary reason why it would need to be. So it could be. I mean, I see what you're saying, but mm-hmm. I don't think it, at least I don't feel compelled by that picture to say, and therefore that's the way it would have to happen. I mean, it could happen that way, but if it doesn't happen that way, it just means that the metaphor wasn't meant to be taken that far.
Oh, yeah, I agree with you. It's just that it seems so strong. That's what Jesus is using as language, and that there's that parallel that makes me think like, that could be what happens. And I know sometimes things are right for the wrong reason. And that's kind of...
Well, that certainly can be true. I mean, what you're saying is dispensationalism may have gotten that right for out of bad thinking about theology and that kind of stuff. Yeah, that's...
Well, not justifying like, okay, you were right, there is this time. I think that doesn't mean that they were right, but, you know, as you said, there is this thing that's coming up that I strongly think it is. But anyway, I'll just let someone else speak.
Good, thanks. Maybe we've got time for one more. I'm sorry I went a little late today.
Ron, my question really isn't on your main theme, but it comes up several times in this text, so it made me think about it. What's your take on the use by Paul and Christ himself in another place when he went into the house of the young girl who had died, using the term sleep and asleep for those who have died? You know that it has led some church groups to not believe that at death we go to be with the Lord, but that we sleep in the grave, unknowing of anything until he returns, and the description of being caught up with those who are alive. How is it used here, and why is it sleep, and why did Christ say of the little gal, she's not dead, she's asleep?
Right. Well, my perspective on that would be that I don't think the word itself solves that particular problem. What I think the reason that sleep is used is in our experience in life, sleep is something that you wake up from, and death is something that you don't wake up from. So, you know, when when Jesus says, you know, Lazarus is asleep, and the disciples say, well, if he's asleep, then he'll wake up. And Jesus says, no. He's dead, okay? I mean, so, and I'm going to go wake him up. I mean, it's basically, so I think the idea, the reason that sleep gets used is the idea that this thing, you know, death and sleep have that, you know, that similarity. Is it Shakespeare that talks about sleep as death's other self or something like that? The similarity between being asleep and being dead is that you're lying there not doing anything, you know, in both cases. But when you're asleep, you're lying there not doing anything only to awaken to life again. So I think that's why the language is used. And I don't know that it solves our problem as to whether that idea of soul sleep, you know. And I have to admit that I'm kind of open to either direction on that question. I've seen some things that might indicate that that would work, but there are other things that make it sound like we are indeed going to something, being with Jesus, and something going on in this period before the time he comes back, and I'm not sure on that question. What is striking to me, though, is when the authors in the Bible talk about what our hope is, we tend to, when I've talked to Christians, many Christians have basically said to me when we talk about this stuff, you know, my hope is that when I die, I'm going to go to be with Jesus. That's the Christian hope. But what's striking to me is that in the New Testament, the Christian hope is Jesus coming back. That's, you know, they don't say, I'm not saying this language never shows up, but it's, you don't find people saying, my great hope is that I'm going to die and go to be with Jesus. My great hope is that Jesus is going to return and there'll be a new heavens and new earth and all of that kind of stuff. So I think our emphasis should be there. I mean, where the action is in this is what I'm really looking for is for God to redeem creation, to redeem all of what he has made and have it be under the rule of Christ. And that's what I'm looking for. That really is what I'm looking for. Okay, well, I think I'll stop there since we're out of time. Thank you.